Welcome to the Core Security Podcast, episode number 3. I'm Bobby Kuzma, and joining me today are my colleagues Willis McDonald, our senior threat researcher, coming from the Network Insight side of the house, and Alan Diaz, a data scientist and doctoral candidate at Georgia Tech. Alan is one of our maths geeks and does a lot of the machine learning technologies that are built into our products. So, you know, we start out and we're seeing AI and machine learning is this big, huge thing that is being pushed from an advertising perspective in the industry. So why don't we start with what is machine learning and how does that matter to those of us in the security field?
Okay, Bobby. Thanks for having me on the podcast for the first time. So let's talk about machine learning. Is it fair to say that historically in security, we had products like antivirus and firewalls and things like that that were using rules and signatures and things that were sort of programmed in by experts to tell it what was the malicious behavior that they were looking to stop?
Yeah, that's how we've kind of come about, because bad guys use patterns and they're recognizable under expert guidance and you get signatures from that. And sometimes that backfires pretty badly. I remember a number of different antiviruses that will mysteriously decide to eat Windows system files because they happen to match a pattern of bytes. So that's something that as a defender, we look at with a bit of distrust because of the false positive rate. As an attacker, I don't know.
Okay. So it does work to some extent, but you do have some errors, you have some false positives, and also attackers, I guess, get smarter and they learn how these products work and start thinking about ways to circumvent them, right? And so machine learning can help us when it comes to looking for patterns that are maybe too complex, even for an expert to see with the naked eye, or too complex to sort of explicitly program, hardwire into some kind of security software, and therefore they allow us to expand the range of threats that we can detect.
So it's a force multiplier if used correctly.
Yes, and maybe it's helpful to think a little bit about what happens, just very broadly. Is the key to machine learning that differs from sort of what came before is that you, in the supervised learning world, you give your algorithm a lot of examples. And you say, these are examples of things that we know, are bad. And then here are some examples of things that we know are benign, that are, not a security threat. And then by using a lot of examples and coming up with some kind of algorithm that puts your data, usually turns each of your examples into a point in some high dimensional space, then your algorithm learns to distinguish between the good and bad in such a way that sort of minimizes the number of errors. And once you've trained that algorithm, then you can sort of try it out on real data and see if it generalizes well to new examples it hasn't seen before.
Okay, so in the good old days, spam became a problem, and one of the tools that was developed to work with that was a statistical method called Bayesian filtering that involved training data sets of spam versus ham, and there's implementations of varying complexity. Is that an example of machine learning, or is that a precursor technology to what we're talking about today?
Oh, that's a great example, Bobby, of you can use a Bayesian classifier to say, you say, here are examples of spam, here are examples of ham, and let's train a model that can distinguish between these really well. And then hopefully when we see new spam that we've never seen before, and we apply that same model to it, it will do a good job of, you know, of detecting that spam and not throwing in too much of the ham with it. And I think something that spam detection systems use that you know, we also use throughout machine learning and in security is that there's a feedback loop where, you know, if a user says, actually, this one is okay, this shouldn't be in my spam folder, then your machine learning system, you know, takes that in as a new training data, and so it continues to get better the longer you use it.
And with those kind of detection techniques, we end up seeing, in particular, on the spam side, gaming around the system, including chunks of legitimate text in the bottom of the spam email to help outweigh the bad content that's in the Bayesian classifier. So is that a common problem across the entire spectrum of the machine learning technologies, or is that just a Bayesian classifier kind of problem?
Well, so two things about that. I think that's an example of something that we see a lot, I guess, throughout security, right? That's an example of, you know, you have a human adversary who is trying to defeat whatever, you know, whatever security process you've put in. And so in a lot of other realms where machine learning has just seen tremendous success in recent years, you don't really have that problem. So that's one of the things that, you know, that we have to deal with in security. And I would say that, you know, yeah, that is a common problem. I can't think of too many machine learning algorithms that are sort of immune to, as somebody trying to sort of pollute your data sample with misleading examples. But there are ways to, you know, try to evolve, you know, our algorithms to deal with that. But it is a challenge.
This countermeasure side of the farm, this is something that our wily human adversaries are doing. Willis, what's your take on that?
Yeah, and it's something that they're doing quite frequently, at least the ones that are very successful in what they're doing. They're changing up how they communicate with their C2s. They're changing up how they format their messages in order to get around some of these filters and get around machine learning techniques. So it is pretty common to see this done. Once the machine learning systems figure out what the change is, the actors are picking up on that pretty quick and changing on the fly to try and get around some of these techniques.
Have you ever encountered in the wild an instance where a threat actor may be using machine learning of their own to try and classify their own stuff and then evolve around that?
I can't think of a case where I've seen that in the wild. I know it's being done, but I haven't seen it firsthand.
Okay, that's fair. A little bit cagey, but that's a fair answer. Where we're coming from with this is we're essentially using this as both pattern classification and anomaly detection. And anomaly detection's a way harder problem than simply pattern classification, right?
It can be. The issue with using anomaly detection is that it's maybe easy to say that you've seen an anomaly, but after that, you have to decide whether that anomaly is malicious. So it's difficult to come up with an anomaly detection system that only finds the particular subclass of anomalies that you're interested in.
Distinguishing between actual malicious traffic versus just a really crappy implementation of a protocol, for example.
Yeah. And so that's where we rely on our human experts. And also, a lot of security products and, you know, machine learning systems in general really benefit from user participation. So if we detect something that we think is a security breach, and the user goes in and finds out that, in fact, yes, it was or it wasn't, if they give us that feedback, you know, at least our Network Insight product has the capability to do that, then, you know, that feedback, yay or nay, helps us to keep getting better.
What kind of patterns are we looking for when we're feeding these machine learning systems. Clearly, we can't just shove a PCAP of a 10 gig, you know, internet uplink into the system and go, here, find things.
Yeah, right? So in our Network Insight product, we're looking at a lot of different types of data. So, you know, HTTP, metadata, we're scanning binaries, looking at network flows, DNS requests. What am I leaving out, Willis?
We're also looking at the traffic and the format of everything within the actual request going back out to the C2 or any normal requests on the network.
So we're looking at all these different things and looking for correlations between them. It could be, you know, if something matches on a couple of different of those axes against something that we know is malicious, that gives us more confidence that that, you know, we need to alert the customer that something is not right.
So we're not using just a single piece of evidence coming out of a machine learning system as an indictment. We're actually putting together a full case against a particular hunk of traffic, right?
Yes, or against a particular asset. So if we see, you know, a couple of different suspicious, you know, transactions over some short period of time, then that increases our confidence that there's an infection.
We're still even in just monitoring the uplink traffic of a particular installation. We're dealing with an awful lot of data, and we've got an awful lot of these sensors deployed all over the world, and we're sampling some ungodly percentage of DNS traffic across the planet. How are we dealing with that torrent of data and turning it into something that is actually useful for analysis?
So this is the world of big data, which is, you know, I know a big buzzword, and people think about it hand in hand with machine learning, and they definitely do go together. One of the characterizations of big data that I've heard is the three V's. I don't know how widespread that is, but it resonates with me. And the three V's are volume, velocity, and variety. And so if you have all of those, then that's probably big data. And you talked, Bobby, about the velocity in terms of, you know, our sensors having to process this constant stream of uplink data. The volume, as you again said, we're pulling from sensors all over the world. We get a lot of data from our ISP customers. And then the variety, we've kind of touched on that as well, you know, all the different formats of communication. And so I wanted to give an analogy that just a made up one, but that I think kind of illustrates the big data problem. So since we're headquartered in Atlanta, let me give an Atlanta example. Suppose that you wanted to find something out about all the cars in the Atlanta area. Let's say we wanted to, you know, count the number of a particular make or model or year of car. The pre-big data naive solution would be something like, well, take all of those cars and drive them someplace and then count them. And, you know, even notwithstanding our recent traffic problems in Atlanta, that's just physically impossible. So what we do with the distributed computing setup is analogous to saying, let's appoint someone to count all the cars in their own neighborhood and have separate counting happening simultaneously, and then report those counts to some centralized locations and aggregate that information. I don't know if that's a useful example or not.
So divide and conquer methodology, yes. Basically.
And so for us, a lot of times we're looking for a needle in a haystack. So it'd be like saying, out of all the cars in Atlanta, let's find the ones that have a secret drug payload hidden inside them or something like that. But you still have to start by looking at all of them and narrow your way down to the suspicious ones.
Our case, when we're dealing with live internet traffic, not only do we have this torrent of data, but there's also a very limited window where the intelligence that we can gather from that is going to be actionable. We're doing a pre-filter process, essentially, and then performing additional analysis on this in fairly short order. It doesn't do us any good if it takes a week to do a compute job for analysis.
That's true. Certainly faster is better. But there's the contrast between the detection that we do in real time on the sensors that are deployed in a customer's network, and then the analysis that we do on the data that we bring back to our cloud, and that doesn't have to be real time, but we still, as you say, want it to be as quick as possible so that whatever new insights, new patterns we found, we can get them back up into our product.
There's multiple feedback loops going on at different levels depending on how close to the data source we are.
That's right.
We've come through patterns. We've talked about how we're dealing with this kind of stuff. Now, let me shift gears a little bit. And we're essentially fingerprinting all these different types of data and then linking them to particular classes of malicious traffic or malicious actors. Does this help us get ahead in the attribution game?
It does help a little bit. By doing this, we're able to identify these same patterns coming from the same devices and customer networks or from the same customer networks, which allows us to kind of profile the different activities that a particular group is performing on these actual infected machines. So it kind of helps in building this profile of tools that they're using, how they're operating when they've actually compromised a machine or compromised a network. So it does help. It helps a lot. And then once we are able to actually put together this profile and attribution to, say, a single group, not necessarily a single person or, you know, like nation state attribution, but it helps us to feed that back into the machine learning systems also and make them even better at detecting these groups and attributing the actual group back to activity in other customer networks.
That feedback loop enables us to figure out, once we've identified a particular variant, are there other variants in the same genealogy of the malware, and then begin detecting those with a higher degree of specificity.
Right, and not only just the malware, but the actual operators or the actual groups or individuals behind these. We may have seen them in one customer's network and been able to put together a profile on them from that intrusion, and that helps us also identify them in another customer's network where maybe they didn't use the same exact tools, but it was enough of a profile match to then discover other tools in the second infected network and go ahead and build that profile up.
So maybe it's using common C2 infrastructure, but not necessarily the same communications protocols, or using a common crypto preamble for those C2 comms against different infrastructures.
Right. And also, in one case, maybe they deployed three of their tools. In the other case, they deployed, let's say, four different tools on the same box. And that type of activity helps us identify, you know, build the profile around that operator and go ahead and, you know, attribute all of their activities and all of their tools right back to that same operator.
Where do you see, as this technology is continuing to mature, where are we going with this? What does the future look like for our new AI overlords?
I'll give you my take on this. So where I see this going is in the past, we've had this very long gap between where we were able to actually collect data and then have somebody actually look at the data. And you're talking about humans looking at this data, and this could be 24 hours. This could be a couple of days before somebody's actually to review the data. This is actually getting us closer to real time to be able to use the machine learning models to make decisions on kind of the stuff we already know about, and then also point out things that are anomalous almost in real time. So now you have a human looking at something that's maybe a couple of minutes, maybe an hour, instead of a couple of days before they can actually review it. And the machine learning is taking that burden of actually having to look at each incident off of a human.
Yeah, I agree. I think we want to, as much as possible, put only the highest leverage data in front of our human expert eyes. So if there's something that, you know, machines can with great confidence make a judgment on, then we can do that automatically. And for whatever is judged to be questionable but not quite certain, then we put that in front of a human expert for them to make the final call.
So this isn't a set of technologies that are going to replace the trained human analysts. These are technologies that are going to improve their throughput and avoid wasting their time.
Yes, which is a pretty significant accomplishment, but it, at the end of the day, you certainly need to have, you know, human experts who have all that domain knowledge to, first of all, to be designing the detection systems, and then also, you know, helping out with those edge cases. I don't think we'll be getting rid of the edge cases, you know, in the near future.
So it sounds like this is going to continue getting more and more exciting as the technology continues improving in terms of the ability and speed of classification and how that's going to impact the threat landscape as we're getting more inside the decision loops of the malicious operators out there. So, Willis, Alan, thank you very much for taking some time out to chat with me about this. And that's all we have for you all this week. Please take a look at all of the great resources that we have available at our website at www.coresecurity.com, and we will catch you next time.